Everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We do have two cases set for oral argument, but the second one's not till 2:30, so we'll be taking a break after this argument. Maybe somebody will wander in during it, I don't know. But let me introduce you to our panel before we get started. I understand everybody's here and ready to go. To my left, I've got Justice Dana Womack. To my right, Justice Wade Birdwell, and I am Elizabeth Kerr. So unless there are any preliminary questions or issues, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call University of North Texas System versus Lisa Barringer. May it please the court, Ms. Cynthia Akintuba will argue for the appellate. Mr. Robert Goodman will argue for the appellate.
Counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Cynthia Akintuba and I represent the appellant, the University of North Texas System, an agency of the state of Texas. Now, this appeal arises from Ms. Barringer's lawsuit against the university. The facts are straightforward. Co-workers accused Ms. Barringer of making derogatory comments during a workshop. She had a conversation with her supervisor about those comments where she admitted to making comments that were related to the topic, although she denied making the actual comments. Ms. Barringer's supervisor, who was about to leave on a two-week vacation, so this was Friday afternoon before his two-week vacation, he said, I'm going to put you on paid administrative leave while we investigate, but I'll deal with this when I come back. Rather than allow the university to investigate and for the process to play out, and the investigation could have potentially cleared her name, instead of doing that, she resigned. She resigned her position from the university, and after that, there was no investigation, there were no further actions taken by the university, and she subsequently filed her discrimination claim and then the complaint in the county court. But the facts are simple. There was no adverse action by the employer. In order to have a discrimination claim or a retaliation claim, you need an adverse employment action. And you don't get an adverse employment action when you quit your job. And that's the issue here. Now, the appellee has argued that there's a constructive discharge claim. But the facts here, and we've already gone through discovery in this case, so the evidence is abundant. Both sides have had a chance to collect evidence to depose witnesses. And so we have all the evidence that they plan to present in support of their claim. And the facts here do not show constructive discharge. In order to have constructive discharge, you must have intolerable working conditions that compel you to resign your position. Now, working at a university might be very difficult. I'm not sure. I've not had that opportunity. But the conditions here and the evidence here do not show an intolerable working condition, and certainly not one that would compel you to resign your job. And I think the word compel is really important, right? Because you're going to be compelled to resign when you have conditions that affect your safety, your life, or you have conditions that affect your livelihood, your ability to make a living, because the point of work is to take home a salary and support your life and your family. But those were not the cases. Those are not the situation we have here.
Counsel, if I could ask, excuse me, before August 12th, when Lewin, is that how you pronounce his name?
Mr. Lewin, yes.
Before he met with Ms. Barringer, had she had any previous write-ups or any hints that that perhaps her coworkers weren't happy with her or that anyone was complaining?
Taking the evidence in favorable to her, she claims that she had no hints of that. She had no one had approached her, including Mr. Lewin, that she had difficulty with her coworkers. But what the evidence does show, though, is that she was struggling on her main project. So her main project was the Culture of Service project, which was owned by the chancellor, which the chancellor was trying to institute across the university, and she was in charge of getting all the logistical pieces of this project together. And she was having difficulty with that project. And this workshop where she made the derogatory comments were part of this project. And so she had gone to her supervisor on several occasions saying, you know, I'm struggling with this. I can't get the people to work with me. I can't. I'm not sure what's going on. I need your help. And he said, okay, well, maybe you need to give pieces of that project to your co-workers, to your co-directors. And she did not. So even though she did not receive direct feedback that her coworkers were having trouble working with her. She had evidence of that because she was having trouble completing her main project. And so one of the things that's also important here is that without constructive discharge, all of her claims fall away. And so really the issue before you, before this court, is the constructive discharge claim, because there is no reason to go to the next element in the discrimination claim unless you find constructive discharge. But let's say, for example, that you do find constructive discharge, and we move on to the fourth element. Counsel would have you believe that the fourth element can be proved by going back as far back as you can go and collect every potential speculative, conclusory, potentially incriminating evidence that you can find about age, and you just get to throw it into the bucket and call it age discrimination. And that is not the case. The case law in Texas is very clear that in order to prove the fourth element having to do with discriminatory intent, you have to show that the employee was replaced by someone outside the protected class or replaced by someone younger. Well, first of all, she quit. She resigned. So she doesn't get the benefit of having been fired and then replaced. So when we look at that element, what we focus on is, okay, even assuming the worst possible conditions that she was terminated, she was not replaced by someone outside the protected class. She was not replaced by someone younger. Her responsibilities were distributed in order for those responsibilities to get accomplished.
Is there not case law, particularly from the Fifth Circuit, that indicates that type of distribution can be considered to be replacement?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. And in that case,
so, and not only are we're basically looking at the relationship that she had with Mr. Lewin, correct?
Yes.
And so the intent that we're looking at is his.
Yes.
So any evidence that she's put forward with regard to how he treats individuals within that protected class, and specifically with regard to her, that would be some evidence with regard to his intent, with regard to his treatment of her, would it not?
Not completely, Your Honor. So the evidence would be the evidence with regard to her specifically and this particular decision. So because we don't have a termination.
We don't have any evidence in the record that indicates I'm going to fire. We don't have an ultimatum.
Yes.
Okay. And we don't have a statement that I'm going to fire you, something of that nature. And we definitely don't have a statement that I'm going to fire you because you're too old. And all the case law makes it real clear that you're very rarely ever going to get that type of statement from a potential defendant in these cases. But if, in fact, there's a pattern of treating older individuals, older employees of a certain way, that would be some evidence of an intent, would it not?
It would not, sir, because and this is where I think there's a conflation of the two elements, right? In order to prove the discrimination claim, she must show an adverse employment action, which she's trying to show by constructive discharge, and then she must show the discriminatory intent. Now, in order to examine the discriminatory intent piece, the evidence you look at is the evidence around the adverse decision. So because we have no termination here, let's take a step back and say the adverse employment decision was her supervisor's decision to put her on paid administrative leave pending an investigation. Now, when you take his decision to do that, is there evidence of discriminatory intent when it comes to that decision? If you have an employee that makes derogatory comments at a workshop, and then you need to investigate this comment, and you decide that you're going to put them on paid administrative leave, which this circuit has agreed is not an adverse employment decision, was there discriminatory intent around this fact? And the fact is there isn't. The evidence that she's bringing to bear on this decision is evidence of things that happened more than a year before. They happened in 2015. Regarding Louise Hall, for example, the hiring of Addison Green happened in 2015. So the evidence that she needs to bring to bear on discriminatory intent has to be evidence that goes to this particular adverse employment decision. and not to bring everything else that doesn't relate. Because when we look at this decision, it would be very clear, for example, if at the workshop, which she co-facilitated with a younger employee, if both of them had made derogatory comments and she got put on paid administrative leave, we would gladly write the check and stop talking. But that's not what happened here. She made derogatory comments. Her supervisor offered to put her on paid administrative leave pending an investigation, and she refused the investigation that would potentially clear her name. Having done that, she has not pointed to any other situation where an employee was going to be disciplined and they did not receive that discipline because they were younger. All of the evidence she brings to bear are evidence that are not relevant to this situation. And I think in that case, the Supreme Court of Texas is very clear that we cannot use that other evidence of age too broadly. So if you look at Mission Consolidated, the point of that case is the Court of Appeals in that case said that it would be sufficient for the other evidence of age discrimination to meet that element. And the court said, no, that is too broad. Yes, we know we've considered that element before, but there is no consensus within the Fifth Circuit. And even though there is no consensus, we, the Texas Supreme Court, we're going to say right now, that is too broad. Because you can imagine a situation where if you take that element on face value, it swallows up the prima facie case. There is no point of having a prima facie case and having each element distinct if you say other evidence, no matter what it is, whether it relates to the actual conditions, the situation, the supervisor, if you take all of those and you can use that to prove your prima facie case, you would have no, there would be no point for that. And that would put employers at a disadvantage. And I think that's particularly relevant here because the issue here also before this court is the question of jurisdiction. Texas has waived sovereign immunity for viable and actual claims of that violate the act. And so in order to move on, sovereign immunity has to not apply, correct? And because of that, every element needs to be specific and there needs to be boundaries around those elements. And that's what the Supreme Court was concerned about. It said, It is important to give concrete guidelines on the basic facts necessary to establish a presumption of discrimination. And so if we're going to take the route that even the otherwise evidence of discrimination applies, we have to put guidelines around it. And counsel has not offered any guidelines other than to say, well, here is the bucket, let me throw it at it. Something's bound to stick, and that's not true. It needs to be things that are similar to this situation. And even the cases that Appellee has cited in their brief are cases where when the court looked at evidence, the court looked at evidence of how other employees were treated in the similar situation. So, for example, if we take AutoZone, which is the first case where the Texas Supreme Court outlines the elements, the court looked at how one employee who was accused of making derogatory comments about a female employee and a younger employee, and the older employee was terminated. And the question was whether the younger employee was treated favorably. And so the court looked at the evidence around that investigation that the employer conducted, what evidence was before the supervisor. The court did not go back and say, well, let's take a look at everything that this, you know, possible supervisor has ever said about age or about has ever done or taken action about other employees that are not before the court. And Ms. Berenger does not have standing to assert the rights of other employees that are not before the court. So I think the evidence needs to be limited, and that because this is a jurisdictional analysis and not just a merits analysis, it has to be specific and concrete. And I'm about to run out of time, so I'll add that even if we say that the prima facie element is met here, she has not shown that the legitimate reasons the university had for terminating her are pretextual. In order to meet pretext, you have to show that the reasons they give are false, and that it's not only false, but it's also not true in the sense that it did not actually apply equally to her and other employees. And that's not true. She admits to making the comments. Now, would we know what comments she made without an investigation? No, there's no way to know that. But she refused an investigation. So she cannot get the benefit of an inference that the university acted wrongfully when she's refused, when she refused the possibility that they would act, they would find out that she did not make those comments. But the actions the university took and the proposed paid administrative leave, there's nothing to suggest that that's not what would happen in any other case if an employee made those comments. In conclusion, we would ask that you reverse the lower court's decision and, in fact, dismiss this case because sovereign immunity continues to apply and they have not met their burden, which is their burden, to show that the state has waived jurisdiction in this case. And so for all those reasons and the reasons, my time's up.
Thank you, counsel. Response?
May it please the court. The court has two issues to address here at a most general level, factual and legal. The county court made quick work of this, saw issues of fact all over the place on not only the constructive discharge, but the elements of a prima facie case as well as pretext. Court can read the transcript. It found ample issues of fact in all respects.
Counsel, are you aware of any cases where somebody's been placed on paid administrative leave and that's considered to be enough for constructive discharge?
The issue here is not whether somebody was placed on paid administrative leave because she wasn't, in fact, she wasn't given that privilege. The harangue that I call that is an unprecedented, in my experience, attempt, and as Justice Birdwell noted, a proof of the intent of Mr. Lewin to see to her leaving, because it was not limited to this notion of allegedly making a prejudicial comment. They're turning a comment about Brexit into alleged racist comments, which she denied and which are not credible for reasons stated in the briefing.
Well, so why not welcome the investigation?
Because he already prejudged it. In his conversation with her, he said, and the exact words of the testimony are quoted, that I'm not sure there's any point in doing this. It was absolutely prejudged. His entire attitude in forcing multiple issues upon her, not limited to the one which is now being suggested as the one, and in essence speaking with multiple Freudian slips, frankly, about his own attitude, talking about the possibility of an investigation, but his thinking that that really isn't worth the time anyway, his making it all about him, I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks. The issue of any pay, which was, again, denied, was her saying, well, as long as you're going to be gone, I'm a civilized person. I generally give 2 weeks' notice. That's what you do. Well, that you know that didn't happen because his hand, he forced her hand by the cavalcade of threats that he made. They were threats to terminate her. They were prejudgment of what she said based on no attempt to verify what the facts were. In multiple respects, and as you've already elicited, there was no prior disciplinary history to support that. The suggestion that others not cooperating with her is somehow proof of her being inadequate in some way just doesn't make logical sense. She was overloaded, that's apparent, but to say that others were complaining about her when she was actually saying, I'm not getting the cooperation you would have expected on this chancellor's project, that's the opposite. That's not putting her in a bad light, it's putting others in a bad light. But she wasn't doing it for that reason, she was being descriptive about it. But again, the absolute prejudgment, in his own words, is the reason why this case. And there's not a an ultimatum theory of the case or an intolerable conditions theory of the case. It's a spectrum of circumstances, and both the federal and state cases combined present a spectrum of circumstances. And it is really, ultimately, as Justice Birdwell's comment suggested, a question of intent. That's why it's called constructive discharge.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Let's assume that what you're saying is true and it's reflected in the record, that in fact the statements made by Mr. Lewin that I'm not sure why we're doing this.
Right.
Okay. She's offered the opportunity to go through an investigation on paid leave. Who would have been doing the investigation?
Well, that raises an interesting question, because he was the head of system HR, and
as far as policy is concerned with regard to that type of on paid leave internal investigation, is there any policy in the record that would reflect who the decision maker was going to be as to any potential discipline? And was there any type of policy that set forth, is there some type of tiered disciplinary? In other words, what you've been arguing now is effectively that by his prejudgment, okay, he made an ultimatum. And you've basically that I'm intending to fire you. I don't know why we need to go through this, other than I'm sure some policy requires me to do it, so I'm going to do it this way, but I'm going to end up being the judge and jury on you anyway. And understanding that her at that point in time, you're arguing she had enough information to realize the choice she was being given was resign or be fired after the sham of an investigation was going to be done by the very person who would make that decision. What I'm not sure I have seen in the record is, what does the record reflect as to does he actually have the decision after that investigation? Is he the decision-making person? Are there any appeals, even if he is that person? Okay. In other words, before you get to the ultimatum, you have to show there really is no clear alternative to her, and I think the case law y'all have both cited has indicated that.
I think the best answer I'd give, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any, there's no procedure in the record reflecting that, and what he did with his words concerning this whole matter was reserve the decision to himself after he returned from vacation. There was nobody else to which reference was made as being in control of that decision.
So he didn't say anything like, I'm going to let so-and-so investigate this, and when I get back, I'll talk to them and find out what's going on, what happened. Okay.
No, I think the whole notion of this theoretically fair investigation is really a gloss on the fact that he was going to be gone for 2 weeks, and he'd think about it, and when he came back, he'd make the decision then. I'm not sure that there's nothing in the record about some formal investigation, but I'm not sure that there's anything in his testimony, either on direct examination or cross-examination, about some specific formal procedure and some specific formal vesting of somebody else in the decision-making right to make a decision after 2 weeks.
Whatever. Now, because of her position in HR, and she'd been there for a while, she presumably would have known what the procedure would have been for that type of investigation, would she not?
Your Honor, I don't know that, as the brief indicates, the HR group within the system was formed when HR units within individual campuses were rolled up. I'm not sure how established it was, but there's nothing that suggests that he contemplated others making the decision after 2 weeks other than himself after he got back from vacation, had slept on it, or had done whatever he was going to do. But he was impatient with that, as the prejudgment suggests. It was like, I'm telling you this, but then again, why am I even waiting? Because, and the court can read the deposition testimony that is annotated in the factual section. There is this spectrum of circumstances which can give rise to constructive discharge. The county court evidently thought that that this was a very granular set of circumstances, and you know, sometimes the granularity of the arguments made in a summary judgment case are the clearest reflection of the fact that summary judgment is not appropriate when you have to make distinctions so fine that they are really jury arguments. If I may, on two other aspects of the case. On the retaliation claim, they have not made any argument in their brief, nor at all argument about the retaliation claim. The proof is that she made complaints to another, formal complaints to another HR representative within the group that was overseen by Mr. Lewin twice, once within several weeks of Mr. Lewin's harangue of her, which was accompanied, as the court may see, by this collection of notes, most written on the same day, but all written within 3 or 4 days of each other, like he was collecting them to unload on her, which is itself suspicious. But the she made these formal complaints within several weeks of the last one. This happened. The temporal proximity is well within the 4 months that is spoken of both by in Texas case law and in most recent federal case law, this Garcia case out of the Fifth Circuit that I cite.
Okay, and, you use the word formal, okay? How do we determine that those were formal complaints as opposed to I'm just going to go talk to
Ms.
Finney about the fact that Mr. Lewin, every time I ask him I need some help, he won't even respond to
me. Well, the plain fact is that they don't need to be formal, but she made the distinction in these instances between herself, that his treatment of her and his treatment of Ms. Green, his other direct supervisee. So, as I said in the brief, no magic words are necessary, but they don't even contest in the brief or at oral argument the sufficiency of those two complaints to him as protected conduct. And then the causation is not only supplied by the temporal proximity, but by the other circumstances, the fact that it was not just the one reason related to this co-facilitation of a seminar, it was multiple reasons presented to her at the same time. And then, honestly, in the TWC presentation made to the TWC on the unemployment, it was a whole other group of reasons. There's no consistency. So while, and nobody has acknowledged this, I tried to acknowledge in the brief, when you have a constructive discharge case, the application of the pretext model is difficult because obviously you don't have reasons given to argue against, but I think the surrogate for that and what the cases suggest and certainly what logic suggests is that you look at the reasons that underlay the threats of termination, underlay the just the psychological imposition of the harangue itself, and see whether those are true. Let me make one other point about retaliation. Under the Burlington Northern versus White decision, which has been followed in Texas state courts, an act to be retaliatory doesn't have to equate to a concrete adverse employment action. It can be, to use Justice Breyer's words, not inviting somebody to lunch after they make a complaint of sex discrimination. Here we have this harangue, this concentrated psychological imposition upon her, by which Mr. Lewin obviously got what he seemed to want. And I just want to call attention to the fact that there's frankly, the damages issue may be a different one, but I'm not sure constructive discharge is even necessary to make a retaliation claim. Let me address this issue of the fourth element. There are a number of cases, both Texas and federal cases, which are completely ignored in the analysis. This Garcia case, which on page 23 of my brief, is extremely self-limiting in its holding. The Supreme Court took pains to say, this is when somebody's alleging age discrimination, but for heaven's sakes, they're replaced by somebody older. This is an extremely narrow holding. There are 4 or 5 cases between Reeves in 2000 and the Garcia case cited on page 25 in which courts have understood that in a case, an old boys club kind of case, in a sex discrimination case here where somebody was called old school and where 4 or 5 people in a row who were over 40 were replaced by people younger 40, and I've given you the names and the times and the circumstances of all of those, for heaven's sakes, if a court is asked to ignore, much less a jury, asked to ignore the series of replacement of older personnel by younger personnel. The epithet used with respect to the oldest individual, who was in her 70s, then we're all being ostrich-like knowingly and intentionally, which is not what the discrimination law encourages. Texas has, since the Texas Labor Code was passed in its prior form, said that discrimination, distinguishing it from retaliation, discrimination is based on a motivating factor test. Ultimately, the jury is asked, was age a motivating factor? Pretext is one way to get there, but even if the reason is true in a true termination case under Desert Palace, which again is followed by Texas courts, if there's reason to believe that it was nevertheless age-motivated, sex-motivated, religion-motivated, disability-motivated, it's illegal under the Texas Labor Code standard of motivating factor. You don't have that test under the federal age discrimination law anymore because of the Gross decision, but it still is the case under Texas Labor Code. And you can't square their misconstruction of Garcia with the fact that under the Texas Labor Code, all the discrimination claims are based on a motivating factor test. And that allows mixed motive under Desert Palace. It allows the classic pretext test under McDonnell Douglas. The facts here and the law dictate affirmance and to send this case back to trial so that all the facts can be heard and not just the mischaracterization of the facts offered in the brief and today.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Prejudgment. That is what they're hanging their hat on. That because the supervisor, Mr. Lewin, had an impression of whether or not the allegations were true, they have met their jurisdictional burden, and that is not what the case law says. First of all, conversations with an employee were to discuss performance, criticism, work performance. Those conversations cannot be the basis for a discrimination claim or a retaliation claim, where the conversation is actually about the employee's work performance. And so his main issue is that he prejudged the investigation, which that's a human response. When you hear something, you have a prejudgment about whether or not what you're hearing sounds right. And so every time an employee, a supervisor, prejudges a situation, we will not be in court. That is the position they're taking, and that's just not tenable. Because in order to prove your prima facie case, you have to show each element, and the most important element is whether or not the supervisor actually took adverse employment action against you. Now, going to some of the things that he's brought up, because once again, it's this throw the bucket at the problem approach that they've taken, as opposed to what's really in front of this court, which is a jurisdiction issue. And jurisdiction is not a triable issue. Jurisdiction is a matter of law for this court to decide. And in order to say that sovereign immunity has been waived, the court has to make that decision and not a jury. So one of the things that they mentioned over and over is that there were a series of memos to file, and all of these memos came all at once. The record is clear. Mr. Lewin testified in his deposition that he created memos in the regular course of practice. It was his course of practice to create memos. And in fact, one of the memos in the record goes back to 2015 with regard to the Louise Hall matter. The second issue is the culture of service project. All of these memos occurred between August 4 and August 12, but they all actually relate to the same subject matter. On August 4, Mr. Lewin asked Ms. Beringer to ask for help on the project. She went to Ms. Vandeventer to ask for help, but the way she asked for the help caused Ms. Vandeventer to be upset. And so Ms. Vandeventer went to Mr. Lewin to complain about the conversation. And so that's the first memo we see in the record, which is from August 4. And then they co-facilitated the workshop. And then the workshop happened on August 10th and August 11th. During the workshop, You have this question of Ms. Berenger making derogatory comments, which Ms. Van Deventer again found upsetting. Again, she took this to her supervisor. And so all of these memos did not appear, but they came because they were all around the same issue and topic. And it's the very same issue that Ms. Berenger concedes that she went to talk to Mr. Lewin about. In her deposition testimony, she says that she initiated the conversation on a Friday afternoon before he's going on vacation. You bet he's not trying to initiate hard conversations. In her testimony, she says she initiated the conversation. In fact, she also testifies that when he said, I'm going to put you on paid administrative leave, she said, are you going to fire me? So she initiates the question about termination as well. And he says, you know, I believe this. He gives his impression of the allegations, but his impression of the allegations are not sufficient for them to meet their burden, and once again, it is their burden. And the fact that they have no evidence in the record of who would have conducted the investigation, there was somebody in this office under Mr. Lewin who has the title of EO director. She never once complained to him. In all the complaints that she supposedly made, she never once went to him to start an investigation about her allegations of discrimination. But she complained to people who thought she was talking to them as a friend because she had worked there long before Mr. Lewin came there. The last piece I would like to say is that there is no doubt that Mr. Lewin and Ms. Berenger had different working styles. In the deposition, it's clear that he was a hands-off manager. And she wanted guidance. She wanted more concrete steps. She wanted him to take concrete steps. In her deposition, she says, to remove obstacles. I see that I'm out of time. May I finish my sentence?
You may. Quickly. Wrap up.
To remove obstacles from her way. He did not take those actions because of her age. He took those actions because his supervisory style was hands-off. She wanted a hands-on supervisor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. Your oral argument has been very helpful, and your case is now submitted, and we'll take a break before our 2:30 argument.